listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Tonight we're joined by a woman who contributed to and became the editor of Tiger Beat magazine from the mid-60s to the early 70s, Anne Moses. Anne Moses is the author of a really wonderful new memoir. It's called Meow, My Groovy Life with Tiger Beat's Teen Idols. And if you were a teenager in the 1960s, then you'll love this nostalgic book about a girl from Southern California who became the voice of every teenager in America. And she's here with us right now, groovy. Anne Moses, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
I loved every page of this book, and I was really sorry when it was over. But I want to start by asking you about Disneyland. I made my first trip to Disneyland in 1958, and it's it's loomed large, you know, in my life ever since. And you had the best e-ticket ride of all time because you worked there. How did it start?
Well, I was really fortunate. I had a high school boyfriend whose father was the manager of Sunkiss on Main Street. And back for the first 25 years of Disneyland, a lot of people don't know this, all of the places on Main Street and a few other locations, like Sunkissed in Adventureland, where I worked, were operated by lessees. In other words, it was not the Disney Corporation. They leased the space. So if you bought a Mickey Mouse watch from the watch shop, you were buying it from an entrepreneur who put that shop up, or the Magic Shop, or Sunkissed, or Carnation, and so on. And it was only after Disney saw the incredible success that all the lessees had that they not only changed it after 25 years at Disneyland, but when they created Disney World, it was all theirs, every bit of it. And they also realized they had made a huge mistake at Disneyland by not buying enough land.
Right, and they almost ran out of space. They had to go underground.
And so they corrected that with Disney World. They bought up a ton of Florida.
So you had a connection that got you into the Sunkissed
booth. I did.
I remember that Sunkissed booth, but tell me the location. It was in Adventureland across from the Jungle Cruise?
Exactly. So all day, besides serving orange juice, and it was called Sunkissed, I presume. Like
yes, I get it.
You get it. But what I would listen to all day for the years I was there, because we did have ticket books the whole time I was there, was the, you know how you had your guide on the river cruise who would tell you how the hippos are only, you only have to worry if their ears are wiggling, and of course the animatronic ears would be waggling. And so when people would wait in line, they would be entertained by one of the guides who would say, tear out your e-tickets. That's E as in elephant, E as in esophagus. And they would go on and they would make jokes. But we would hear the same spiel over and over again over the microphone, but you know, then someone would change it up and you'd just crack up and you'd be standing in front of somebody and you'd be laughing and they'd kind of look at you like, why are you laughing? But it was a heck of a fun place to work, that's for sure.
It was my dream job when I was a kid. I thought, oh, someday I'll work at Disneyland, but that never happened.
I loved every minute of it. I really, really did.
Well, so you actually encountered Walt Disney there at least once, right?
Just the once, but it was very momentous for me because they teach you, everyone who works there, even if you aren't working for Disney, you have to go through 3 days of Disney University. And the education that I got at Disney University in those 3 days has carried me throughout my whole life in the way that you treat people properly, the way you give the best customer service, and of course the entire Disney operation was a first name operation. So if a supervisor would come up to whether he wanted to get a cup of coffee or, and they were mostly men then, but that's why I'm using that pronoun. But if they would come up, you would say, well, hi, Dave, or hi, Bill. Even your highest boss, you called by your first name. And it made it like a family. And it was a wonderful, it was just a wonderful attitude to have. You know, still being respectful to them, but also as close as maybe a family member that you would call by your first name. So you were told in Disney University, if you ever encounter, you know, Walt Disney, you can call him Walt or Uncle Walt, and you shouldn't call him Mr. Disney. And therefore, when I was faced with that, when he walked up to my counter one morning before the park had opened, I said, hi, Uncle Walt, what can I get you? But I was still just, like, starstruck and you know, I could barely move.
That's such a great story. I wish I was there. So Disneyland. He was
such a nice man, and just he reminded me of my dad. And he was just such a genuine person. I mean, when he said the things he did to me, he was just being 100% genuine to this person he'd never seen before, and it was remarkable.
So, tell me now, Ann Moses, you became a music journalist, and you worked at Tiger Beat magazine, and I remember Tiger Beat really well because I was a fan of all of the bands that were covered in Tiger Beat, like the Monkees and so forth. So, Tiger Beat was a new magazine when you got there. How did you get your foot in the door at Tiger Beat?
Well, I had been writing for a little music newspaper out in Fullerton, California, and it was called Rhythm and News. So they intended to focus on rhythm and blues or soul music, and I did a lot of coverage of the black artists in South Los Angeles and visiting artists that mainly played in the clubs in South Los Angeles, like the Miracles and James Brown, and I can't think of all of them, but saw some amazing acts. And then one time I was up in Hollywood with one of the other volunteer writers for Rhythm and News, and she said, wouldn't it be great if we could get paid for doing this? And I said, oh, that, you know, it hadn't crossed my mind, but I thought, that sounds amazing. And she said, I'd like to go to work for Tiger Beat. And I said, what's Tiger Beat? Because I was in college at the time. I was still working weekends and summers at Disneyland. Plus, I was volunteer ushering at Meadowlands Theater so I could see the roadshow musicals, which I adored. As a result, when she said Tiger Beat, I had no idea what she was talking about. Well, in September of 1965, they had brought out the first issue. They got the endorsement of Lloyd Thaxton, so it was originally called Lloyd Thaxton's Tiger Beat Magazine, because they felt that his daily record show and dancing program would give them the exposure they needed to get the ball rolling. And so they used his name. So I think I picked up a copy in the fall of 65, and I noticed that Derek Taylor was writing a monthly column. And I knew Derek because he had been the Beatles publicist, but then he moved his family to the United States and was doing publicity for the Beach Boys, the Byrds, and all of the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars, including Paul Revere and the Raiders. So he was often calling me to say, would you come up and do a story on this? We, you know, trying to get his groups more exposure. And so once I knew him, I thought, gee, well, I always took him copies of my articles because I thought these publicists would, it would just be like the right networking thing to do, to not only, you know, have them set up an interview, go do the interview, have it published, but then get back to them and say, here it is, or isn't it neat we made the front page, or look at the two-page spread they gave us, at this, you know, just kind of toot your own horn. So in the process of doing that, I was taking a Beach Boys story by to show him, and I said, gee, do you think you could get me an introduction to the Tiger Beat people? And instead of giving me some drawn-out explanation or say, well, maybe, he just picked up the phone, and he said, hi, Ralph, I have someone I'd like you to meet. Do you have time this afternoon? And he said, yeah, have her come over at 4 o'clock. So he said, can you go to their offices at 4 o'clock? And I said, absolutely. And an hour later, I was in Ralph Binner's office and showed him some of the stories I had written. And he said, well, why don't you write a couple of these up in Tiger Beat style, which was definitely different than Rhythm and News style or the junior college paper style, where I was trying to be fairly, you know, serious journalist, no matter what I was writing about. And I, of course, got so excited. It happened to be a Friday afternoon. As soon as my classes were finished on Monday, I was on the freeway up to take Ralph my rewritten story. And he was happy with what he got, although when they ended up being printed in Tiger Beat after they had hired me, he still added more. You know, he added a line I was writing about being in the hotel room watching Hullabaloo with the Dave Clark Five, and he put in a line that said, even their toes were cute. And so that wasn't me, but I learned to put those type of things in.
Well, give us a little bit more of what the Tiger Beat style was like.
Well, it was a little bit of original slang, I would call it. I mean, we called picks, P-I-C-S, and then if there were multiple picks, it would be P-I-X, and everything was groovy or out of sight or awesome. And the topics of interest were always had to include, you know, what is someone's favorite color, what's their idea of the perfect girl, you know, what kind of girl catches their attention, it was Charles Loffer, the publisher, it was his really vision. He felt this was a magazine for preteen girls and young teenage girls. And what I was not aware of until I wrote this book and started my blog 5 years ago, was that Tiger Beat had a huge male audience. And I think if he had been aware of that then, we might have done things a little differently and, you know, made things more more generic for everybody, you know. But in our minds, we were writing for preteen girls.
Well, I was a boy, and
I know, and I found out you were not alone, and so I hope there was enough other good info there that kept you reading.
I was just as likely as anybody to put up a picture of David McCallum on my wall, you know.
Oh, well, awesome.
Derek Taylor, that's such a great story. What a wonderful guy he was.
Oh, absolutely. And then of course, because I knew him, I started covering a lot of his people in Tiger Beat, so they were getting a lot more exposure. But then he was so wonderful because he was the one who set up. He said, I mean, he called me and said, would you like to go to the Mamas and Papas recording session? And I said, oh, I sure would. I mean, I was a fan like everybody else of the songs they had brought out, and to go and attend their recording session, and which was I saw her again. They were adding on to some of the background tracks to the lyrics of I Saw Her Again, and then short, you know, not too long after that, he was, you know, instrumental along with John Phillips in creating the Monterey Pop Festival. And of course, I had front row seats for every single show the whole time. I mean, I had an all access pass, and I mean, what an unforgettable experience. It's really hard to describe.
It's just being a fan watching, even though you were a journalist, you were a fan.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was no way you could put, you know, story after story after story in Tiger Beat. So it was just a matter of, in Tiger Beat, I wrote a lot about what their favorite stars were doing at the Monterey Pop Festival, how Peter Tork introduced Buffalo Springfield, if I'm not mistaken, or he introduced the Birds. I can't remember, but it's like the Monkees were hanging around even though they didn't perform, and Peter introduced some, and then, you know, everybody was dressed so crazy, and I was shooting lots of pictures, so it was just, it's 3 days I'll never forget.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and tonight we're talking with the former editor of Tiger Beat magazine, Ann Moses. Her book is called Meow, My Groovy Life with Tiger Beat's Teen Idols. Ann Moses, you know, today we like really classify our music. And when we look back on the 1960s, we see the Monkees and Dino, Dizzy, and Billy, you know, in a very different category than the Jefferson Airplane and Hendrix and the Who, you know, pop music versus rock music. But it seems from your book that you and Tiger Beat didn't draw that much of a distinction between the styles.
Not at all. It's like we were trying to show, you know, not only the pinups, you know, which we knew were going to go up on what we thought were the girls' walls,
and
exactly, and a lot of others too. And we wanted to cover some of the different groups. You know, it's not like we were going to do a three-part life story on Jimi Hendrix. But would we put a picture of Jimi Hendrix setting his guitar on fire at Monterey Pop? You bet. And so there I was just covering the whole thing. So some of the pictures made it into Tiger Beat. I think some eventually made it into New Musical Express. But there's no way I could write about that whole time, that whole weekend experience, because that we didn't feel the reader was looking for that. They were looking for us to sporadically cover all these different groups and the new groups coming over from the UK, but it's only the ones with the cutie pie boys that were really going to get monthly coverage.
Well, Ann Moses, your book, Meow, My Groovy Life with Tiger Beat's Teen Idols,
was groovy.
It's very detailed. So did you have a personal journal that you kept in those days?
I didn't. I'd give anything to have done that now, because I did not keep a personal journal. So when I realized that my name was out on the internet, that if you Googled Ann Moses Tiger Beat, 60 pages came up on Google, and I only found that out like 5 years ago at my workplace when I was showing a few pictures to my coworkers, and they started Googling me, as millennials will do. And it was like, oh my God, I was bowled over that this was going on and I wasn't even aware of it. So once aware of it, I said, well, what if I started a blog? And that's you know, I started my website, annmoses.com. I started writing these stories, and I just put them in sequence and kind of told them in the order of things happening to me that I thought would still be interesting today for people to read about. And when I got a great response from that, then it was, you know, people had been saying to me over the years, if I had mentioned my former career, they would say, oh, you should write a book. But I thought, I'm not a book writer. I'm not an author. I wrote for a teenage magazine. So in my mind, I couldn't conceive of it. But once I had written like 5 or 6 of these blog posts, it became clear that if I would just expand upon those and share some of the private stories that went on during the time that never appeared in Tiger Beat and my readers, you know, I wouldn't imagine that they would care about my private life. But then in you know, 2012, it really became clear that not only did they, you know, think it was cool that I was still around and I was writing these stories, but they said, well, we want to know about you. And again, I was just flabbergasted. But it was also then that I realized if I can put enough blog posts together, it could be a book. But I also knew I couldn't do it alone. And that was how my my editor, Ann Wicker, and I came together. Actually, the girls at my work, when they Googled me, they found a blog post she had put up when Davy Jones died. And in her blog post, it said, when I was 12 years old, I wanted to be Ann Moses. Wow. And when I read that, I mean, mind blown. That's all I can say. And so I wrote Ann an email message, and I said, this was the coolest thing I've ever read. And once we emailed a few times, we said, well, let's chat on the phone. And I get her on the phone, and she lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. So here's this girl with this southern accent, just sweet as butter. Every time I talked to her, I just giggled. As I got to know her, I found out that she had been editing books for many years with her Master of Fine Arts degree, and she had written her own book about musicians of North Carolina called Making Notes. So once we started talking, she said, yes, you can write a book. And I said, well, I definitely, you know that I can't do it alone and that I need help with somebody who knows what it takes to put a book together, because that certainly was not my strong suit. So we started having annual meetings at different places around the U.S. that one of us hadn't seen, and we'd have week-long writing sessions, and little by little, we put it together. You know, are we going to do it chronologically? You know, how are we going to structure this? And then toward the end of the book, we had the book written, and it was during that time that I had another person from years ago that knew of me. I didn't know of him. And I got an email, well, not an email message, a messenger message from Robert Pala. And he wrote and said, oh, I gave a lecture at ASU today. I've been a journalist for 30 years. And you inspired me to go into journalism. And that, I about fell out of my chair when I'm reading his message. It's like, are you kidding me? So I wrote him back, and I said, oh, I'm so sorry I missed your lecture at ASU. You know, I assumed he was some visiting writer that was giving a speech to the journalism department. And then he writes me back and says, well, you know, I live in Phoenix, and so, and I write for the Phoenix New Times. And anyway, long story short, when he was 9 years old, he wanted to be me. And those are his words. And he did go into journalism. He is just an outstanding journalist and writer. He just won the Pulliam Award. And once Ann and I had what we felt was our strongest work together, then he did a final read-through, and he cut out, because he wrote a book on John Waters, he knows how a book should go together, so he was most helpful in cutting out whatever would stall the progression of the writing and storyline, which I couldn't do. So he was able to just make it more concise and really keep it flowing. And your compliment that you paid to me when you first opened the show was that you liked the way, you know, the book flowed along and you wanted to keep reading it. And he, I feel like he gets the credit for that, because that was the final touch that really, I feel, made it come together 100%. And plus, I made a new friend, and he and his husband are my husband and my best friends now. We see each other. We cook together. We have an incredible time, and he's a remarkable person. So it's all these good things happened from that one crazy day in the office where I was working when the millennial kids started Googling me on their phones. And I mean, wow. You know, what has happened since that day is just remarkable.
Well, you know, I think it's the stuff about you personally to me is the highlight of the book, and that's when I wanted it to continue. I wanted to know everything that happened to you. And I can also see that, you know, you probably lived with this in your past for a long time, and I wonder, were your friends and the people around you like, wow, you know, shocked that there was this past that you hadn't ever mentioned?
The majority of them, absolutely. And in fact, some friends that I knew shortly after I left Tiger Beat and I happened to move away from Los Angeles, they said, I never knew you knew all these stars. You didn't talk about it, and which was true. I mean, my new friends were in their mid 20s. I thought they don't care about, you know, what happened 5 years ago or the Monkees or anything like that. I mean, it was an assumption I made, and may have been true, may have not been, but. But I especially had one friend who wrote, I didn't know you were such a strong woman and kind of fought for your rights and stood up for yourself and were assertive. And then, of course, I've had a lot of comments from readers who have said, wow, you were really, you know, you were really fighting for women's rights and before it was popular. And it's just been, the response has, you know, I'm running out of adjectives.
And you were doing it all in a miniskirt or pantsuit.
I was, and most of them were made by my mom.
Oh, that's the sweetest. You know, the fact that you are real, that there really was an Ann Moses, because we know now that the romance comics of the era, for instance, were written by cigar-smoking men, middle-aged men, and you talked about how your boss was the one who was saying how cute their toes were. But, you know, here was a real girl who was really doing, you know, all this great stuff and writing about it and having their picture taken. And I want to hear so much more about it, Ann Moses, but it's time for a break. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. We're talking tonight with Ann Moses. Her book is called Meow, My Groovy Life with Tiger Beat's Teen Idols. One of the things that's been in the news lately is sexual harassment. And it seems that some of it came your way. You want to talk about that a little bit? Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I can use the hashtag MeToo. Fortunately, I was never raped. I talk a bit in the book about the incident where Tony of the Sandells you know, I mean, I invited him into my room, but that was my naivete, thinking he was just coming in to shoot the breeze. And it was very naive on my part, but he made it clear that's not why he was there. And he came on to me and exposed himself and, you know, intended to get it on. And I put a stop to that pretty quickly. Now, that's how it turned out. I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I want to have some fun. And I said, get out of here. You know, go find fun somewhere else. Well, what if he hadn't just gone out the door like when I pushed him out the door? It could have been kind of ugly. And then another person that came on to me was Derek Taylor. And I did go into detail about that encounter, but then we decided to take that out of the book.
Oh, I see.
And it was not today it would be, you know, an attempted sexual assault. He just stuck his hand down my blouse and was feeling me up, and he was making out with me in his office, and I just kind of stepped back, and it was very obvious I was uncomfortable. I mean, the guy had 7 kids, and to me, he was an old man. I think he was in his early 30s.
Yeah, that's old.
To me, it was. That's for sure. And he could tell I was very uncomfortable, but he just stopped, you know, and that didn't go any further. Never brought up again, did not interfere with our working relationship. So that one was a pass too, you know. It turned out okay, and I wasn't traumatized or anything like that. And then another time, I don't write about this in the book, and I probably should, just to share my story, because somebody's going to say, well, that happened to me, but I didn't think that was sexual assault. And today we know that it is. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I was not overly traumatized by it. I have to say that. But uncomfortable, absolutely. And one time I was interviewing James Burton, Elvis's guitarist. And he lived, I don't know where he lived in Southern California, but we ended up, I invited him over to my house. Now, I was married by this time. It was like 1969 or 1970, and I was married, but I had invited him over. We did this extensive interview on what's it like to be Elvis's lead guitarist and, you know, some behind-the-scenes stories. And then he just started coming on to me, like putting his arm around me and attempting to, get romantic. And it was, I pushed him off and said, whoa, wait a minute, not cool. And I mean, I was 2 or 3 years older by that time than the first incident. And at least I had it together enough to just go, cut it out. What are you doing? And again, he knocked it off, and nothing more came of it. But I'll tell you, it was the weirdest experience when I saw him not too long ago on American Pickers, which is a TV show where these guys go out and find antique treasures. And they're at James Burton's place in Tennessee, where he has a guitar collection or something or other. And it was like, and I mean, he's really, he has a long beard, and he looked like an old man.
Well, it was like,
oh my goodness. It was a very bizarre experience.
A great guitarist, but.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Loved his performances, but those are my Me Too stories, and I was fortunate that they weren't like horrible experiences that I can't get out of my mind, because that's what many women go through, and you know, I'm glad it's coming to light. That's going to help the situation, and it shouldn't be going on anymore.
Yeah, so you were not a groupie. Absolutely not a groupie.
No, I was not.
Did you encounter groupies that wanted that were like, oh, you could help us get into the stage door and things like that?
You know, there were sometimes, and you know, they would try that approach because they had tried others and they didn't work. Sometimes there were groupies already around, and you know, that I paid no attention to because obviously that was somebody's choice, and it didn't offend me, it didn't bother me, and I just did whatever. You know, whoever I was interviewing, I continued the interview or, you know, observing them in a recording session or whatever. The only one that was totally bizarre, and I do write about this in my, it doesn't relate to groupies, but I can remember being extremely uncomfortable. When I interviewed Andy Williams, they had asked me to interview Andy Williams for the New Musical Express. And because he was going to come over and appear in the Queen's big Christmas show. And so I went to interview him. He had the Andy Williams show at the time. And his former wife, Claudine Langer, who had, you know, gone steady with and been accused of murdering Spider Savage, the skier, she was there, and she had brought a new record out. And as soon as we started the interview, it was in his big dressing room. It was like a big trailer on the set, you know, almost like a mobile home. So it was very roomy. And I had asked him one or two questions, and then she sat down on his lap, and in between questions, she'd kind of make out with him. And I was just dumbfounded. It was like, what is going on? Is she trying to get attention? Does she... At the time, I didn't even know how to analyze it. I mean, today I would say, was she, you know, did she want me to write about that to make it more interesting, to get her some press or get her publicity?
Maybe they were trying to seduce you into a groovy threesome, Ann Moses.
No. It didn't come off that way, for sure. I think I would have figured that out. But anyway, it was so... weird. And then, you know, Andy Williams was always an older man to me, and so it was like he was really older. I'm sure he was in his 40s then or something. So it was bizarre, and I do write about that in the book, just because it was like, oh well, you know, never underestimate what you're gonna encounter in Hollywood, ever.
Now, what if Elvis had come on to you? Now, Elvis came on to a lot of people. Would that have made a difference? I mean, you do write in your book that Roger Daltrey came on to you and you said no thanks. But
Right. And you know what? He just politely invited me up to his room.
Yeah, that
so
wasn't.
He did, and it was at, you know, the record, their album debut party put on by the record company at this hotel. So, I mean, when I declined, you know, he just said, okay, and it turned out to be no big deal. So I don't include that in really coming on to me, just saying, you know, would you like to come up to my room?
I'm sure. Sure, that's just asking you on a date, right?
Yeah.
Sort of.
I knew exactly why he was inviting me up to his room. And that's why I declined, because I was a big chicken.
So what if? Because you did meet Elvis. There's a picture of you and Elvis together.
It was. And my first husband, who I married in 1969, he was an enormous Elvis fan. And quite frankly, the way he felt about Elvis, he probably would have approved, oddly enough. But... you know, it never crossed my mind, and I really did not think that would ever happen, because I think he probably went for way prettier women, you know, just like knockouts. And that's not how I perceived myself, certainly. And so I didn't have to worry about it. Never happened. And then I heard from one writer who, you know, knew some of the girls that would go and visit Elvis in Vegas that he was super boring in bed. I don't know if it's true or not, but I'm just sharing the rumor. They just said he was really old-fashioned, and so that made him boring in bed.
You took some great pictures of him.
Oh yeah, that was another. I was so lucky that happened. I'm so lucky they turned out, because they could have been solid black just as easily as turning out well. So that was really fun. But it was another example of, you know, if you don't ask, you're never going to get somebody to say yes to you. So it's just, I just pushed on ahead and said, hey, how about, you know, and they had made it clear nobody's going to get to take pictures. But that didn't stop me from going and asking and getting permission and making it happen. So
you got close but never met the Beatles, is that right?
Correct. I was about 4 feet away from them, maybe 5 or 6, at the press conference. You know, it was my brother that got to spend 2 hours with them trapped under Dodger Stadium. But I only wrote extensively about that on my blog, but my brother was a rent-a-cop while he was going to dental school at USC, and he and a friend had heard at Disneyland that rent-a-cops were hiring, and because they both were street sweepers at Disneyland weekends and summers, and they got hired and they got booked to you know, guard the Rolling Stones at one of their shows in L.A. And then when the Beatles came to town to play Dodger Stadium, they got called. And, of course, my brother had his name tag on, which said Moses in big letters. And his friend was named Jimmy Crisp, but it was spelled C-H-R-I-S-T. So his name badge pretty much said Christ. And this was
Christ and Moses guarding the Beatles.
Exactly. That was my hook. And then it was my brother who picked them up and took them from the house in Beverly Hills to the concert. And then they were trapped under Dodger Stadium for 2 hours before they could get out. And my brother and Jimmy Chris, they just sat with them, and John Lennon said, talked to him about, oh, tell me what Disneyland is like. I've always wanted to go to Disneyland. And then they signed autographs for him. So my brother never knew the end of the story, because when John Lennon asked for his name badge and then Paul asked for Jimmy Chris, he said, oh, can I have your name badge? I'm going to wear it. And of course, my brother never knew if he followed through with that until one of my readers, Jim Mulahy, said, here's a picture of John Lennon the next night at Candlestick Park backstage, and he had my brother's name tag on, and sent me the picture, which I had never seen. Honest to goodness, when my brother saw that, it made him cry. It was like, He couldn't believe that he did what he said, and here he was finding out. So it was a wonderful full circle kind of story.
Well, and Moses, it seems like you have to write another book. This book, Meow, My Groovy Life with Tiger Beats Teen Idols, it's such a wonderful book, and we haven't even talked about Dino, Desi, and Billy, and Mike, David Cassidy, and all the other people that you met and wrote about.
Well, you can call me back.
All right, I'll do that. thanks for being with us here on From the Bookshelf. She's Ann Moses, and the book is called Meow, My Groovy Life with Tiger Beats Teen Idols. Ann Moses, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, and it's available at Amazon.com.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Anne Moses. Her book is called Meow, My Groovy Life with Tiger Beat's Teen Idols. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we'll see you next time.